have a friend in Atlanta who says in 1969, when she was 6 years old, she found a poster in one of her older sibling, I think her older brother had a magazine. It was a poster that said, "Make love, not war." Some of you have seen that poster, I bet. So she thought that was a great idea, so she put it on her wall. Her father walked in and immediately burst out laughing, and she couldn't understand that. What could possibly be funny about that? Well, 10 years later, she kind of got the joke and understand that love might mean more than just some idealistic thoughts of a six-year-old, although that's a good place to start. Human history could be read, couldn't it, as humankind's experimentation to find the best way to create a world where love and peace are everywhere. As I was thinking about this for no reason at all, you may remember the comedy Lysistrata, one of the great plays by Aristophanes. It was presented in Athens in 411 BC, and it's about Lysistrata, this woman who's decided she's had enough of the Peloponnesian War that's been going on forever, so she gathers all the women around her, and they decide they're going to stop making love until their husbands stop making war. It's a great story. This is certainly, right, a more creative way forward than what the dictators and tyrants do. They want to end war, of course. They want peace, but they want to achieve it by absolute power to silence and kill their enemies. I believe Hitler wanted world peace, but he thought he had to kill the Jews and millions of others to accomplish it. Others, less violent and controlling, decide that the way forward is a society. If you had a society that teaches and then strictly enforces the law, if you could just teach everyone the Ten Commandments and then punish those who break them, you could achieve peace and harmony. Many Christians, some of you may have been raised in just such a community. Many Christians ascribe to this strategy, even though St. Paul is crystal clear over and over when he says the law, it's a good thing to know, but the law ends up making sin and sinning more powerful and prevalent. And you say, well, how can that be? Well, St. Augustine in his great Confessions, his autobiography, in the 4th century, talked about when he was 11, 12 years old, he and a bunch of his buddies in North Africa decided to go steal the pears out of his neighbor's pear tree. So they climb up over the wall, they go in, steal the pears, come back. And then as he reflected on that later, he thought, number one, they didn't eat the pears. Number two, they didn't want the pears. Number three, they got rid of they threw the pears away. So the only reason they did this was because they wanted to experience the thrill of doing something they know is wrong. Because in them, as in each of us, there is an emptiness, some existential lack, and we just think some shiny new object, we could just have it, or at least have it illegally, that it would fix us. Whether it's stolen fruit or money or success or control, if I could just get everybody in my world to do right, things would be great. Or maybe a new relationship. Those are some of our strategies for making love in the world. God's strategy is very clear. We celebrate it every Sunday. And Jesus Christ, the divine being, which is love, is embodied in Jesus. And Jesus models God's love for us by making friends, as we often say, with those you and I would naturally avoid. We would tell our children to avoid these people because their inner nothingness is so obvious. They don't have the wealth to, you know, have nice clothes to cover it. They don't have the money to get a good dentist to fix their smile. And so you see them and you just know these people, their inner failure is just so out there. We don't want to be near it. Maybe it's contagious. But Jesus not only eats with these people, he is willing to die for these people. And the world says, you want to die? Okay, and they kill Jesus. But it can't keep him dead. So Jesus appears, right? We've been doing this over the 50 days of Easter in the upper room, on a road to Emmaus at the beach, to show his disciples that love, the divine love, is the power at the heart of reality. And if that were all it took for someone just to say that and say, okay, I believe that, we could go home. But the disciples would find out, just like we do, that it's not enough to be hold a belief about Jesus in our head and have that free us from our destructive need to try to fix ourselves. It's easy to think one thing in the mind and to live another thing in the world. We all know. I mean, it's quite easy to believe and to swear that one is not a racist while at the same time going along with economic and social policies that guarantee that people with white skin will end up on top so as we can have all the money we need to try to fill the emptiness with new shiny objects. Such a great distance, isn't there, between head and heart. The good news, however, is that God knows our fears and our destructive strategies, and God is willing to subvert them. In other words, God is not beneath performing a magic trick or two to bring us into the kingdom. And I use those words because I came across a book and then a guy in a podcast named Peter Rollins, a philosopher of religion. This book is called The Divine Magician, The Disappearance of Religion and the Discovery of Faith. Very easy book to read. And he says, remember, you know, back to the time. Maybe some of you did. Some of you were magicians. Any of you got any high school magicians here? Most of us like going to see magic shows. Or if we saw the movie The Prestige came out a few years ago. So it's in that movie, it says there are three stages to a magic trick. The first is the pledge. And that's when the magician shows you a white dove. And there it is. There's the pledge. The second step is called the turn, in which the dove is placed behind a curtain, and when the curtain is open, the dove is gone. Now you see it, now you don't. And you might think, well, that's pretty amazing, and everybody would clap and go home and say that was great. Well, no, we wait for the third stage, don't we? We wait for the third stage called the prestige. The prestige in which the dove appears again under the magician's hat. How did that happen? So Rollins says, consider, hope you don't find this profane, consider the Holy Eucharist as a magic trick. Now, of course, you may be jumping back into church history back in the Reformation when Protestants would try to discredit the Catholic Mass by saying, oh, they're just performing magic up there. They think they can make Jesus appear. But we know the Lord's Supper is simply a memorial about what happened in the past. But Rollins says, consider the Eucharist as a positive magic trick. After the priest consecrates the bread and wine, and they're held up, there is the divine presence, the risen Jesus for all to see. That's the pledge. And then the second stage, the turn, the people come up, receive the bread and wine, and the divine disappears. It disappears. We consume the divine. God was there, but now God is gone. And everyone wonders, what will the prestige look like? How and where will the divine presence reappear? Well, this is where our desire to keep God outside of us in control, so we can control God, gets us into trouble. Certainly gets me into trouble. I've been to countless worship services that faithfully follow the Book of Common Prayer. And at the end of the service, even as great as everything was, by the end of the service, as I'm walking out, my sense that I came in with of unworthiness, that starts to reappear. My random anxieties begin to reappear. My anger at people around me who just don't do right, that begins to reappear. So obviously, God has not reappeared. There hasn't been any third stage. God hasn't fixed me, so I'll go home disappointed once again. I thought God might show up this time and be that shiny new object that would take away my sense of incompleteness. So I guess there's no spiritual magic in that church. Maybe I ought to try another one, one where the priest has more power than this one. But then I think, oh no, I'm the priest. The problem comes in expecting the Holy Spirit, the dove, to show up outside my life instead of inside my life. What if, Rollins says, after the final hymn, after you've taken communion and God's disappeared and the hymn's over, and you begin walking out and you see a friend, you know they've lost their job, and you go over and say, you know, I was just thinking, I've got a buddy who's looking for someone that does something like you do. I'll give you his name and number and want you to know our family's going to be with you through this no matter what happens. And then you walk a little bit further and then you look and you see someone, they just had a baby, and you go over and say, you know, I'm going to bring a casserole Tuesday night, because I know having a baby, that the family schedule just goes through the roof. What is happening there? The divine presence is showing up. Not outside, but inside. The sacred is not an object that will make us whole and complete, but he says the sacred is the experience of depth we feel in the act of love itself. Holy Spirit is not a thing outside our life, but the sacred presence hidden in our love. He talks about having lives of depth and density. The sacred is a community of individuals looking out for one another, loving and caring for one another. As Jesus said, wherever two or three are gathered together in love, I will be with you. I am there in the midst of you. So, on the day of Pentecost, Luke says there are about 120 gathered, and they're flooded not with another divine being, a third separate thing, Father, Son, you got this third thing, Spirit, a religious object that's going to fix all our problems. No, what shows up is something they can't point to, they can't handle it, they can't control it. All they can do is say, yes, I'll open myself. Or some say, no, I don't want any part of that. I'll search for my wholeness through some more other, better, shiny objects, which the commercials tell me will work better. And, you know, after all, for those on the outside of this event, there are lots of reasons for saying no. I mean, they thought the people were drunk. Who wants to do that? And also, it was obvious these people aren't the kind of people you want to imitate. Who wants to hook up with a bunch of Galilean fishermen? They have so little. No, we want to hook up with the ones that got a lot. But for those who say yes, their world is cracked open. Their lives transformed. Not because God has fixed that brokenness. That brokenness lives with us. It is part of the human condition. It is part of our existence. But because in that brokenness, they experience the infusion of a divine love flowing in them and through them, not for themselves, but for others, giving them the courage, wounded as they are, to connect with those who speak a different language and inhabit a different world. The very kind of people that scare us the most. Holy Spirit transforms an inward-looking tribe into those who go into all the world. Because, as Paul says in our letter, in his letter to Corinthians this morning, they are all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slave or free, male or female, and he said they all drink of one Spirit. So, the dove, you remember the dove that descends on Jesus at his baptism and disappears at his death, shows up within our lives because this is how our amazing God makes love.